From Relay, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of television. This is episode number 92, recorded April the 3rd, 2025. I, as always, am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell, and with me, surprise, is our longtime director of strategy, Julia Alexander. Julia, welcome back.
I am so excited to be back. I'm so excited. Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing great. I have a downstreamfeedback.com email I'd like to read now, a message, which is from listener Casey, who says, is Julia coming back? ? I see that she is now free from her corporate overlords, or you have new corporate overlords, really. And I guess the answer is yes, because here you are. How about that?
Yes, I am back. I took a brief break to go work at Disney, and it was a really great experience. Really learned so much. The being at a company of that size and learning and just seeing like the mechanisms of just, you know, how just how complex everything is, gave me an even greater respect for what the teams over there are doing. But I missed the chaos of media. I missed yapping with my friends like Jason. And so there was an opportunity to come back at Puck or to Puck. And I said, let's do it.
Yeah. People don't remember, but you were at Parrot Research and then sort of moonlighted writing What I'm Hearing Plus for Puck. And Puck really loved having you. And so this is not quite you going back to what you were doing before, because now Puck is your employer. They get you, which is awesome. And you're going to be contributing there in a bunch of different ways. And we don't know what all the ways are. So is Julia coming back? Well, she's here on this episode and hopefully in some future episodes too. But also I want to make sure that that Puck is happy with what Julia is doing. So we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, I would love to not upset anyone. I don't know if people are paying attention to the economy. But, you know, not a great time to be stepping on toes and potentially losing jobs. So, I'm hopeful that we will continue to be on mic friends as well as just friends. But TBD, as Jason said.
TBD. Yeah. And we've had a really great run, especially with Joe and Will. And we'll see how it works out. But I hope to keep those guys involved, too, because they were really great and kept the podcast alive and contributed in their own unique ways. Will, if you don't know, Julia, he was one of the original people behind Baseball Prospectus and has been a great sports corner go-to in your absence, because we know how much you like sports corner.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just brilliant people. Like it's honest, being able to be a fan of it again. I said this to Puck when I came back to Puck, and I'm saying it to you now, it's but true both ways. To be able to kind of go and have a little break, let's use that, go and do something else, and to just be a true consumer of things that I used to work on, it makes me like, in some way, I'm almost like, oh, I don't want to ruin it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's so much better. Like, it's so much better without me. But I am selfishly always looking to yap. So, alas.
No, it's great. I could tell for those listeners out there who didn't subscribe to your Posting Nexus newsletter, that was the part where you kept writing while you were being employed about other subjects. And that's where I could tell like that you really are somebody who you can take the girl out of the media, but because you just couldn't help yourself but write analysis just outside of your area of work. And that was the thing that when I heard you were coming back, I was like, well, I mean, I read those Posting Nexus posts, and it's very clear that you're still thinking about all these things. So you're back in the media game now. It's great.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say on it, because this is a podcast about the future of TV, not the future of Julia. But the last thing I'll say on it is I had a very cool moment. I got into the idea of reading newsletters and writing newsletters like many people who are probably listening to this or who are thinking about it or who love it because of Ben Thompson, who writes Stratechery, who's just a brilliant, brilliant analyst and a great writer. And I emailed him like out of the blue. I was just like, I'm going to take a chance. And before I went to Disney and I said, you know, I'm thinking I've never done that big kind of corporate thing and blah, 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 blah. And I said, what would you recommend? And he said, you know, it really like it has to be your choice. And he said, but it like it really needs to be something that you can't imagine not doing. So even if you were to go somewhere, you're like, I still want to be able to do this thing. And for the first few weeks at Disney, I was like, I'm good. I don't need to write, like, whatever. I'm writing internally for things, like, I don't need to necessarily go do this externally. But the more that I sat with it, the more I was like, I kind of miss blogging. Like, I just want to blog. And it's funny, I never emailed Ben back because I was so starstruck, and it was actually pretty rude of me. So I apologize, Ben. But I thought about that and I was like, oh, yeah, I look at my last 4 or 5 years and the industry, and I'm really happy with the education I got from all these different great, great, great jobs. And it's so funny to be like, and that was the long detour back to media. Like, this is where we're all coming back to. You know,
Ben worked at Microsoft and he worked at Apple, and not for a long time, but I feel like he has a better perspective on the industry, having seen it from the inside. And I can read, as somebody who's never worked for a tech company, I have perspective on, like, corporate things, but not being on the inside of a tech giant. And I will read things from him where I'm like, I see it. Where I can see that experience, even if it was just a little bit, to get the experience of what it's like on the other side, it can be incredibly informative. But, you know, Disney's exactly. Loss is our gain. That's it. Julia, it's time for Sports Corner.
Sports Corner.
Netflix and Amazon are going to be teaming up, because contractually they're allowed to, for Christmas, this Christmas, to do NFL games. And that's because Netflix is now going to be entering year two of their 3-year agreement with the NFL to show 2 games on Christmas Day. And it's a Thursday, which means Thursday Night Football on Amazon Prime Video. And so therefore, it's official now. And John Orend was the first to say this. This is the plan to Netflix games followed by an Amazon Prime game. It's a streaming triple header on Christmas Day, which this comes along with the news that that at least has been reported by Front Office Sports that it is a, quote, virtual lock that the NFL will opt out of its media rights deals in 2029, 4 years early, because the NFL thinks, you know, we're really at peak NFL rights now. If they don't keep going up, they're certainly going to go up. And everybody wants to be their partner, including Netflix and including other people that aren't their partners yet. And so it's a great opportunity there. But what do you think? Not super surprising, but it is going to be a football filled Christmas Day with Netflix and Prime Video doing NFL games.
Yeah. So I've been thinking a lot about this, and I actually think this is a really interesting opportunity for Amazon. And then the other part of the conversation I want to get into with you is the NBA part of this equation. Mm-hmm. And so obviously last year's NFL games did decently for Netflix. They averaged at about 30 million viewers a game. I think one was like 30.8, one was like 31.3. But the issue is, like, those games weren't necessarily great, right? So you kind of watch them. Beyonce did like a halftime thing, if I remember correctly. Yes. And it was like, cool. But the games are not necessarily exciting. And so for Netflix to have this again, it's a great opportunity to kind of sell out that title level advertising, to bring it in, to continue doing live, to own Christmas when they'll have a bunch of other shows and movies coming out within that month. So Netflix is actually, the less interesting part of this equation. I think this is a huge opportunity for Amazon. So to your point, it's basically a Thursday night game. They're going to have this contractually anyways. But if you think about what we know about Amazon's ecosystem, we know that Prime, the retail component of this, is obviously the biggest part of the business that Amazon thinks about, kind of alongside AWS. But the idea that this is going to land on a day where tons of people are going to have gift cards from people that they've seen earlier that morning or during the afternoon, and they're going to potentially be able to do, Amazon will be able to potentially do what they did during Black Friday, if people remember that game, I think 2 years ago, where it was like very janky, but it was like, oh, here's a QR code for like an exclusive deal. You can kind of go in, because that was on Black Friday and Amazon was leaning into it because obviously people are spending time there. And they had all these eyeballs. I think it was about 15 million, 16 million, if I might have been a little bit lower, people watching this game. And so Amazon was like, oh, we can find ways to kind of cross promote our Prime business. I think with the lessons taken from that moment and the jankiness of it and what people responded to, what they didn't respond to, tied in to the gift cards, right? And this is like a business. I saw a figure from some research analyst who estimated that It's like $300 billion in sales for gift cards. I believe that was in the US, which in 2024, which is like a crazy stat. Yeah. Amazon is the second most popular gift card after Visa. And so you have all these people with all this money, and there's potential deals because it's Christmas Day and they have this game. And so now there's this opportunity to not only just show the game and lock in the advertising for Christmas Day from other people, but you also have the ability to hyper-target your own ads that you're going to, your own products that you then want people to buy. You're also going to be able to showcase some of your generative AI abilities in the advertising space, where you can say, you know, here's how we're really going to partner in order to make these deals really work, which then leads into the new year. And clearly this is an area that Amazon is focused on. And so in many ways, the Amazon part of this equation, which they just kind of lucked into because Christmas is on a Thursday, to me is like way more interesting than the Netflix side. But I want to get your thoughts on whether I'm just being zany.
No, I mean, clearly anything holiday related is huge for Amazon. That's why they have the Thursday, the Thanksgiving game, that extra Thanksgiving game. That, I think, was the real coup to have it's the Black Friday game instead. It's the day after Thanksgiving. It's the first shopping day of the holiday season. And there's an Amazon Black Friday game. So smart. Like, just so smart. Because that is all about buying things. So Christmas is, I would say, a little less. But you're right, there is the flip side of it, which is now you're trying to convert all of those gift cards into products and into sales. And so I think it fits with them. Like, Amazon wants to be anywhere anybody is thinking about buying anything. So having money on Christmas, not as great a fit, in my opinion, as doing it, you know, Thanksgiving, Black Friday, because that's the perfect time, I think. And also the Thursdays in between, when they're doing Thursday night football, again, really great territory for them to be in front of people's faces in the shopping season. But it's not bad. I think it's also not bad to have it be not just Netflix on Christmas, that they get to kind of pop in there due to a trick of the calendar. But still, it's pretty good. You know, they're the existing longer term partner, whereas Amazon is sort of like this trial partner that the NFL is going with. And if you're going into potentially having a new set of media rights renewals in 2029, being present and visible as one of the NFL partners at all times, in all ways, is always going to be important.
Well, and I think you said something so important, which was that Amazon knows Black Friday is the kickoff to holiday shopping. They know it is the kickoff to a lot of people saying, I'm going to do a lot of my shopping. Amazon owns that holiday in the United States, really, if we're thinking about it from an e-commerce standpoint. But they paid, if I remember correctly, it was crazy. It was like $100 million. It was an insane amount that they pay to have that game. And so the NFL kind of worked around it. Versus, to your point, they're not paying extra for this. It's just landed in their lap. And so for the ability for them to then say, well, we're not paying extra for it. We don't have to really make this work for us, but we can continue to experiment with the idea of TV shopping and where we sit in this and how we go about and do it and what the potential is. Also, is there a shopping opportunity on Christmas Day that we can really lean into that maybe we didn't think of before? So I think that's fascinating. The other part of it, which I just want to touch upon quickly, is everyone has kind of been pointing to these three games and being like, oh, it's it for the NBA, like RIP. All right, like the NBA, like Netflix, that was the argument last year, was that Netflix was going to cut into the NBAs. You had the games, you had LeBron James say, you know, I love the NFL, but this is
traditionally
this is our day and all this fun
Christmas
stuff.
Christmas Day is for the NBA, traditionally. The NFL is trying to kind of sneak in there. Yeah.
Exactly. And if you actually look at the numbers, like the NBA saw an 84% increase or something like year over year. It was an insane increase. And they were helped in large part because their games are really interesting. They had a bunch of nail biters and the NFL games were relatively meh. But I also think, and I have no data to back this up, it's like my gut feeling, that when you create a day that is based around expectant of good sport, if people are not necessarily getting that from Netflix and the NFL, because all of these games for the NBA were available on ABC alongside like ESPN, ESPN2, Disney+, because they flooded the zone. And broadcast, you know, still makes up 21% of a share of all TV time spent in the United States. It still reaches like 125 million homes. You actually get to benefit from this idea of like it's a giant sports day. And really important for the NBA is that in 2025, it'll be the NBC season. And so you'll also have trained this audience on Christmas Day to basically be like, oh, not only can I, do I, am I enjoying basketball? And maybe I'm more willing to watch more local, more regular season games. But now that you've got more national games with part of this deal, now that those games are not tied to TNT, which is a cable network people don't necessarily have access to, or they're not necessarily getting it on their Bleacher Report Sports Max tie-in because they're not paying for it. Now you can say, well, it's on NBC and potentially Peacock, right? It's on ABC and like ESPN or whatever it might be. It's going to be on Prime Video. So the access to the NBA is going to be much easier to get. And so if you're a fan in that moment or a casual fan, the NBA also has this really strong opportunity on Christmas Day to say, like, if the games are great and we're in the season where if you're picking up on the juice of Christmas Day games and you want to continue watching, it's actually going to be relatively easier for you to do so going forward as opposed to trying to navigate the cable system to an extent, right? Like, there's still the RSN problem. And
sure, but if you're at grandma's house, you could probably tune it to ABC or NBC and see the NBA, and maybe getting to Netflix is going to be a little bit harder. NBA ratings were up. They had their best Christmas Day in 5 years, and that was with the direct competition. They did counter program. I mean, they made an effort to put good matchups on there. They had the Lakers and the Warriors, and that ended up being a close game, which helped them too. There's always that little, is a game good, is a real crapshoot. But some of that is also trying to program those games and get good teams and good matchups that people are going to want to watch instead of sort of tossing it away. I saw a report that said the Kansas City Chiefs have asked the NFL to be considered a regular Christmas Day team, sort of how the Dallas Cowboys and Detroit Lions are for Thanksgiving. I think that's interesting from a branding perspective. If you're a Chiefs fan, I'm sorry, you will never be able to go anywhere else for Christmas ever again. But, you know, they are currently, you know, three-time Super Bowl participant, and they are basically the hottest team in the NFL. Having them anchor Christmas Day, not a bad idea.
No, I completely agree with you. And I also think, too, like, the winner of all this is sports fans, right? Like, whether you want to watch games, there's going to be something for you. And the other part of the equation is that different experiences on Christmas Day specifically get to be owned. You know, Christmas Day, a lot of people go out to restaurants or at bars. It's not necessarily the same as Thanksgiving, although clearly people do that too. But the idea of like, oh, I don't necessarily celebrate Christmas, maybe I'll go get Chinese food or whatever it might be. Those bars may or may not have Netflix, right? Like, that might not be part of their thing, but they will have ABC and they will have ESPN. And so the ability to say like, oh, there is a component of the NFL here on Netflix and Prime Video for people who want to watch it. And, you know, the NFL is the most destination based thing in the world. People don't have to, you don't have to tell them where to get it. They'll just go find it. But having that be a little streaming bonus treat, and then having the NBA kind of be like available to all of America in different ways, especially including streaming, if you want to get it on Disney Plus or whatever it might be, ESPN Plus. But I think that actually creates a really beautiful world for sports fans on Christmas Day. And I like the idea that Christmas Day is like a bit, can become a big sporting thing outside of just the NBA. I mean, like in Canada, Boxing Day, which is the 26th, kicks off the World Juniors, and it's a big like hockey moment. And so having that period really be a great moment for sports fans is like something, I think it's a win for everyone.
We can come back to this perhaps in a future episode, but do you have thoughts about the NFL opting out of their deals? I'm not surprised, because it seems like if there's anything that's going with an arrow going up, it's the NFL, and they have so many potential partners that, like, Netflix, it seems to me, wants to be, you know, in the NFL business, and they're only barely in it now. And there are other partners like Apple that might want to be in that business and bid for Sunday Ticket, or there's Google itself. And would they be interested in something further in that relationship? And I'm also struck by the fact that they're talking about going to an 18-game schedule. They're talking about expanding international play even more, where you essentially would have like a whole season's worth of games that are neutral site games played in international locations at different time slots. That could be a different package. And also just the fact that the NFL package as it's built was built for two broadcast networks in the 1970s, essentially. And they could completely blow that up and rethink it in order to maximize their revenue and honestly maximize their exposure, because anywhere the NFL goes, it's very hard. I mean, you said it, the NBA can compete with them on Christmas Day, but like, if you're, especially college football, which has spread to sort of every time slot outside of the NFL time slots, the NFL could take a lot of that stuff back too. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about the NFL apparently saying open for business in 2029.
Yeah, a couple, just like small ones. They're not well thought out, but I remember having this conversation with somebody once at a, ironically, an NBA tournament. I won't say who it was, but I was having a conversation. I talked about, you know, like, okay, sports streaming, this is what's happening. Great. Like, snooze. What was really interesting about it was I, you know, we were talking about whether or not these leagues would ever just get rid of their broadcast partnerships entirely. And they said, well, no, for two reasons. And I think about this a lot. And they said, the first one, which makes sense to a lot of people, they'll hear and they'll go, that's true, is it opens up a lot more investigation into consumer protection and the ability of, like, is it fair for consumers to have to pay more to get access to a sport that was relatively available for free, because football is so national, like it's such a national game. And so the ability, being like, oh, well, now Netflix owns this and they're charging X, maybe it's on a specific tier or whatever it might be. We've already seen kind of subcommittees at the Senate level have some conversations about mm-hmm. this. And so I think with the NFL specifically, because it is America's sport, no offense to baseball, as I wear my Yankees cap, but like, because it is America's sport, I think it gets really, really interesting in that division. The second one, which I think about a lot, and I think about this a lot as it's an increasing part of sports business, is the gambling component, right, which is gamblers, and the most hardcore will go to like actual sport betting bars, want up to the minute, like they can't have lags, they can't have things go down. And I think this is the number one issue with streaming, is you know Netflix with Jake Paul and Mike Tyson still had lags. It wasn't as bad as it used to be, but it still had lags. MLB TV went down on opening day. So the idea that people don't have access to this is going to cause a lot of consumer upset, especially if they can't fix that kind of streaming bit rate. I think it's the wrong term, but kind of that lag. And so I think the broadcaster is like the thing that they keep saying is we are it. Like we are the safest bet you have in this world for that type of huge audience, sure, kind of tuning in at once. And I don't know if, you know, 5 years down the line, what the technology looks like, this could be a non-starter, right? It could be like not an issue at all because the way things move. But I wouldn't count out the broadcasters yet. And I think also the NFL, like the NBA, and not that the NFL needs it as much, but I think they like having that huge access. I mean, again, it's 125 million homes. So if you cut off that and you cut off people, you know, even just stumbling upon the NFL, which happens less often than other sports, but the idea of like, oh, right, there's a game on and I'm seeing it on my TV right. guide, and like that ability to just channel surf and make everything destination based. I don't know if the leagues necessarily want that, which is why the broadcasters are always a huge part of the equation.
So a couple data points. One thing that the NFL does that's super smart is that if it's a local team and it's not on a broadcast channel, they put it on a broadcast channel in the right. local market, which is really smart because it means your local team will always be there no matter what. And they make a little money on that because they have, you know, some local channel will spend money to get that game and all that. I will say something while you were gone that we noted was Fox made a thing about how they were building I think it's in like Tempe, Arizona, a streaming hub where for the Super Bowl, they were going to minimize the lag of their stream. And by mm-hmm. all accounts, it varied from device to device, but that there were some devices at least where the lag was extremely low latency. And that is an interesting angle where Fox feels like there's some value in getting the latency down, which I think I agree is partially a betting angle, because you can't really do a lot of in-game betting if you are an indeterminate amount between 30 seconds and a minute and a half behind. Like, you can't. I was watching a San Francisco Giants game yesterday, and my watch tapped me, and I looked down, and it was a live activity from the MLB app telling me that it was 2-0 Giants. And then I looked up at the screen, and Wilmer Flores hit a home run, and I was like, yep. Oh, well, that's not great, right? Like, yeah. That's not great. I got spoiled by my own watch about it. And bettors can't do that either. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there. I think you're right. If I had to predict what will happen in 2029, it will be that they will still have two partners that have broadcast networks that they can put games on, so that they have this very broad approach. But my guess is that they will shave those packages down as much as possible, which we saw in some of the complaints about some of the other packages that have gone. TNT's complaint was that they were going to shave that package down, and for the NBA, But this is the world we live in, is there's like the mainline package, but instead of it being, NFL's already been doing this, right? They spun out Thursday night, and then, you know, they spun out Christmas, and they spun out Black Friday. And the idea that you would, and they had the NFL Network for a while, the international games are like that. But that's, I think, where you'll see it, is that they will take games out of the core Sunday afternoon package and find other places to put them with other partners, because it's in the NFL's best interest, as we know, to have everybody as a partner, because among other things, if everybody is an NFL partner, everybody's kind of happy. Everybody wants the NFL to be happy. Coverage of the NFL gets better, strangely, because if you're a journalistic organization that's also a rights holder, guess what? The NFL leans on your company to prevent you from writing negative things about the NFL. Everybody, you know, is happy in those scenarios. Yeah. So I think that's what they'll do, is they'll shave down those Sunday afternoon packages a little bit and find places like maybe the international games, maybe some other time windows where they're not barred, where they could compete with college football, which is going to take every single time slot that's available to it.
Yeah.
So, and try to make money off of it. But never count the NFL out. They are the big dogs.
No, absolutely. And I'm willing to put a bet right now that the two broadcasters they are not going to walk away from are ABC. And well, they're not necessarily on ABC, but I think there could be a deal that's an ABC Disney deal. And then because that would include potentially flagship and whatever it might be. And then NBC. Mm-hmm. I think no matter what happens in the next 18 months to 2 years of consolidation, which will happen, I think Comcast comes out on top in a lot of ways because of its internet business. And so I think if you're the NFL, there is a component of like, okay, well, we want NBC, it's got a huge reach. And by the way, both NBC and ABC have less of a share than CBS does.
Right.
But I just think Paramount is such a big question. So regardless, it ends up being
that's true. The CBS issue is a real question, but there are other options there. I would also say, when we talk about sort of like tinkering at the edges, if they really like their relationship with an ABC, ESPN, or an NBC, and you know, technically with some exceptions, it's Monday Night Football and Sunday Night Football, but like, they've already been experimenting with the idea of showing a game on ESPN and a different game on ABC. You could have a scenario, and NBC's experimented with having some Peacock games plus the Sunday night game. So there are other ways to sort of like bulk up those deals and have them be worth more money. But there, I agree, there is a question. Fox and Paramount, Fox and CBS, like those are currently the hinge deals. And maybe the answer is that CBS is still got a deal, but it's a lot less than it was. That's a possibility, that it's just, you know, they feel comfortable in pulling a bunch of stuff out of there and putting it somewhere else, like an alternate Sunday night and an alternate Monday night. A Monday night doubleheader every week is a thing that would be very easy to do. Put one of them on ESPN and one of them on ABC, stagger them, throw in a Manning cast. You're making money. So
agreed.
Yeah. I have one other little sports corner mention before we move on, which is just that, this was happening when you were on the podcast back in the day, and it was happening while you were gone. This whole RSN thing that your colleague John Orend has referred to as the glide path versus the cliff path, which is cable companies jack them up onto a higher tier where they have fewer viewers and therefore make a lot less money, or do they keep them on the regular tier? And this was just a note. You mentioned your Yankees hat. I wanted to mention, which is Comcast, which mostly in the New York area serving like New Jersey, but Comcast had one of these battles with the Yankees about the YES Network, the Yankees RSN. And in the end, after a lot of political pressure and some pressure from the FCC, they kept it on the glide path instead of the cliff path. But it's interesting because Comcast has taken their own regional sports networks and put them on the cliff path. They basically put them on premier tiers. If you're in Philadelphia or San Francisco, you need to pay more to get your local baseball team on cable TV because it's now on the enhanced plan or whatever that is not as broadly available and is more expensive for customers. So the Yankees avoided it for now. I mean, they're not going to be able to avoid it forever, but they avoided it for now, and Comcast will charge every single one of their New Jersey customers a little bit of money that goes straight into the pocket of the Yankees.
You know what's so funny? I only have one thing to say on this, and I'll keep it short. I think these conversations that these executives have and are so funny to me, because you're thinking about who this is for, right? Like, who is the person who's like navigating all this and is worrying about the blackouts and all that? There are apps, like, you can just download them on your TV. There are apps that are $20 and they're VPN services.
Yeah,
and then you could just go in and you're like, I'm just going to say I'm out of market when I'm not in paid, you know, less, because Gotham is $4.50 a year or whatever for like the combined. It's so funny to me. And this actually leads into our next conversation, because I have thoughts on this there. It's so funny to me that, like, no one addresses the real problem. It's like, well, we're going to figure out how to kind of make sure that this deal lasts, and because we can't lose that revenue. It's like, you're the next generation of people are never going to come in because right. they have found other ways to do it. But that's my take as someone who gets very upset about Yes Network.
It's just, I feel like hey, if they want to keep the spigot on a little longer, they're welcome to it. But it's all, I think the stat last time is like 28 of 30 teams now allow you, 27 out of 30 teams will allow cord cutters to just buy in market games, double what it was last year. So it's going to happen. Rob Manfred wants it to happen. But the RSNs, I mean, look, hey, the Yankees said, we're the Yankees. We're different. You're going to give us money. And they caved. So good for them, I guess. Let's move on to talk about something you wanted to talk about, which is out of CinemaCon, the debate about theatrical. We talked about this, you know, post 2020. There was a lot of what's the size of a theatrical window? How long do you have to wait before you can get it in your home? And then when you get it in your home, what form does it come? Is it on a streaming service for free, or is it something you pay $20 for, like Wicked, which made apparently $100 million on that premium video on demand window that they were in when they were still in theaters and just after they left theaters. And I get that the theater people are upset about it. And I thought this was an interesting take from Michael O'Leary, who's the head of the industry group Cinema United, who said that the problem is the instability of the window, the bouncing around confuses consumers. People don't know, when can I see it in the theater? When does it go to my home? And like, do they assume that home equals free? Because like in the case of Wicked, that wasn't true. If you wanted to watch Wicked, you could, but you'd pay $20 to do it as a rental. So what do you think? Why did you want to bring up the premium video on demand versus theatrical debate? It's a classic. I mean, downstream topic.
It's a classic.
Though.
Yeah, it's never going to end. It's kind of like the RSN thing. It's just never going to end. This is going to be an ongoing conversation until we, you know, die. But here's my thing about this. Because I think Michael O'Leary is right in that it all comes down to audience training. You can see tweets. I saw one today that was like about the new, there's a new like comedy that hit Netflix, I guess, recently. And it was in theaters, like, I guess, 2 months ago or something. And the person was like, why go to the movies if you can just wait for Netflix? And that is true. Like, that audience training is done. The other part of the story, though, is when you look at the data, it's like the vast majority of these films make like 80 to 95% of their revenue in the first 30 days. And then if you look at the type of, I'll give you Wicked as an example. Wicked's a great example. So Wicked makes, I think it was 89% of its total box office revenue in the first 30 days. In the additional 15 days between 30 and 45, in which the theaters dropped minimally, I think it was like 0.04% drop in theater screens. Because the other thing that happens was that once things go to digital, sometimes they just drop the screens completely. So once that additional 15 days, Wicked makes like, I think, 7% or something of its total revenue within those days. And then it declines from there. If you look at the PVOD, there was a press release put out from Universal that within the first seven days, first week of Wicked being on PVOD, which is that, you know, $20 tier, whatever.
Yeah.
In the United States and Canada, it made $70 million. That means that $70 million in PVOD is the exact, I think the difference ended up being, Jason, like $80. That is the exact same amount of money that they made in theaters in those 15 days. The difference is that whether it's Google or Apple or Amazon, whatever it is, the cut that Universal takes from those sales is 80 to 85% compared to the 55 or 50% that they'll get from the exhibitors. So it does generate more significant revenue. Now, this is a short-term solution to a long-term problem, because the long-term problem is audience training. To Michael O'Leary's point, if you're saying that people don't necessarily want to go to the movies in order because they're expecting to be on streaming, then saying like we're going to be in theaters exclusively for 45 days might mean that people are going to like, okay, well, I know now that I have, you know, just over a kind of month to go and do this, month and a half to do this. But this doesn't take into account like the biggest issues. And the biggest issues is not necessarily these 15 days or people thinking like, oh, I can watch this on Netflix, which by the way, it's like so rare. Usually they're going to PVOD before they go to any type of actual streaming right. window that we think of in terms of like the SVOD services. So it's still costing you $20, $25 to rent or buy it, whatever it might be. But what are the main problems? Theaters are not great experiences anymore unless you're paying for a premium type theater like an Alamo Draft House. And even then, the idea of going and spending the amount of money, which is the biggest problem, is the cost of it, is like going to bankrupt you. I'm thinking about everything that's happening right now in our economy. Literally, as Jason and I are recording this, right? Like the stock market is down. Crashing, things are happening. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's everything is going to become much more expensive for people. You want them to pay $80 for a family of four to go see, and that's just ticket prices, to go see a movie like Wicked. When they could argue, well, if I wait 45 days, even if it's in there 45 days, if I know I can pay $20 to own it at home and my five-year-old can watch it however many times they want, like that is your inherent issue, is you have to make your theaters better and you have to find a way to not put the cost of this on the consumers. And therein is the issue, because the exhibitors saying, well, we can't take on any more costs because we're not doing well. I know half of them are like close to bankruptcy. The studios are saying, well, our business has been disrupted, because you think about a company like Disney, right? So like cable's declining. And so Disney's got a great theatrical business. It's one of the leading theatrical businesses. But like where you can kind of take some of this extra money from historically is no longer there. And they're trying to prop up a streaming product. You know, this is like the conversation that happens with the tech giants, which is the reason that Amazon and Apple can continue to invest at the levels that they do in content, is because they can just take it from somewhere else and it doesn't really matter to them. And so I think we need to be going way beyond the scope of just, oh, it's 30. It's an issue of 30 to 40 days, an issue of audience training. It's like, no, it's an issue of, yes, audience training. It's an issue of supply, absolutely. But it is also an issue of like, your theaters are not fun to be in. Your theaters are not amendable to people's current attention span. So you want to let teenagers use their phones, like use your phones. They're expensive for a family to go see, and getting more expensive. And most of the films are kind of met, right? So unless they're big blockbusters that really require that IMAX screen or like a Christopher Nolan movie, most movies are kind of like, okay, well, I can wait for that to come out because I'm not in an incredible rush to see it. And every time CinemaCon happens, we have the same conversation. And the reason I wanted to rant about it is because of what I was ranting about with like the RSN thing, where it's like, well, people are just going to get VPNs, like, and they're just going to change to their location. There is a lack of commitment to the risk required to actually affect real change. And so that's why we're going to have this exact same conversation next year. Like, you can put it in the books, Jason.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be the same thing.
I can see a stabilization of the window. I can see that. I think that what happened with the pandemic and, you know, Warner Brothers pulling their stuff and putting it straight onto Max and all of those things, like, okay, I think that that is going to stabilize a little bit more, and the windows are going to be, maybe we can do some audience training. But you're right. That's not enough. There needs to be more. I've definitely seen that here. Our biggest theater in my county closed, but another theater that was closed reopened, and it got a huge upgrade. Like they took out the little rows of seats and put in like cushy reclining seats with big spaces between the rows. So their capacity went down, but obviously very few movie showings were ever using all that capacity, and they made it an upgraded experience. And I went and saw a movie a few months ago, and I thought, oh, this is actually nice, right? Like, and I'm like, I see now this would be a way that you could get me to come and spend that money, because yeah, just for me, it was $15 to see a movie on a weekend or on a weekday in the afternoon, and not cheap for one person. So, you know, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. And the audience training is part of it. I'd say the audience training might be the easiest part of it. The rest of it's going to be hard.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Here's a funny story that I wanted to share with you, that this came by literally right before we were recording. Got some Blue Sky posts from Joe Adalian and Matt Bellany about this. The list of the most streamed licensed television series came out for the latest month. And at number 8 on the list is Gunsmoke, a show that ran for 20 seasons. It was at one point, until I think SVU passed it, the longest running live action series ever. It last aired a new episode 50 years ago. It placed 8th on the licensed streaming list for the week of March 3rd with 646 million minutes. Now, I will say it did run for 20 seasons, so there's lots of episodes of Gunsmoke you can watch. But it is also fascinating to see the deepest of deep catalogs, a Western made 50 to 70 years ago on the list. But there it is at number 8. I don't know what does it say about catalog titles that Gunsmoke is number 8. I would love to hear it after saying, I want to repeat Matt Bellany's joke, which was congratulations to the cast and creators who are all dead.
Incredible. Matt's so funny. It's every time I think, I'm like, wow, what a great thought I had. He has like just something that's wittier and more insightful and
amazing.
God, he's great. Anyways, here's my take about Gunsmoke is that the fact that it is popping at the same time as 1923 is not a surprise. I think because they're both Paramount Plus and I think it's also Peacock.
Yep,
I also think Peacock. That is a very telling data point about the confirming who we know the audience of Paramount Plus to be. Like, it is an audience that is probably over the age of 65 that is like streaming some shows. They like 1923. It's only on Paramount Plus. They're going in there. Once they finish an episode, there's a thing that pops up and says, if you like 1923, you might like Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
And it turns out that there is. And then there's younger people too. I'm not just saying it's only people over 65, although I think there's that stat from Nielsen that's like half the Gunsmoke audience is over 65. That I think says so much about Paramount Plus. And I also think for what it's worth, I think like it's a great data point for Paramount. One of the things that streamers have got to stop doing is trying to be everything to everyone. It doesn't work unless you're Netflix and like maybe Hulu. So instead, if Paramount Plus, which is leans into an older audience, which is also like CBS's audience anyways, and says like, we're going to be for like old dads or like old retiree couples or just like, you know, older people in general, not just necessarily like people who are geriatric, but older people who are embracing much more streaming in general. There's like great Nielsen stat about like the percentage of YouTube share that was spent with people over the age of 65, like grew exponentially year over year. It's like 90% or it was like 100% growth. It was like crazy. There is a generation who is not dead and is like not actively dying and who you can find new advertising opportunities toward and also they're less likely to churn and return, right? Like these are pretty stable customers. Now, I'm not saying again that CBS and Paramount Plus should just be like, and we are for people in their 70s. But if you have these newer shows that work across the board and to an extent like the Yellowstone universe, if you have the ability to say, okay, well, this is going to bring in a certain audience that maybe Mayor of Kingstown isn't going to necessarily bring in. Hmm. And that audience can lean into Gunsmoke, which is going to make us, which is going to increase our watch time. It's going to increase our ad inventory, whatever it might be. That's a huge win. And so I actually think it's like a very funny story, but that is actually pretty insightful in many ways. And so I'm just happy for people who are, I'm sure, returning to Gunsmoke, having not thought about it in years.
Or are of an age where they're a little too young to have appreciated it because it went off the air in like 72, 73, something like that. It was on syndication forever, though. I remember it from syndication for sure. I would also say, I don't know who is the owner of that IP, but I would imagine that there are ears perked up that are like, who owns do we own Gunsmoke? Well, let's get a Western. Like, and if I don't own the IP, I'd be like, can we get a Western? Do we own any Western brands? Can we just make a Western? Because if 1923 is helping stoke interest in kind of Western programming, then maybe we'll see a wave of other shows trying to capitalize on it. By the way, I love that you tied 1923. That's the Yellowstone spinoff with Helen Mirren and Harrison Ford. A nice cast. I'll point out James Arness, the star of Gunsmoke, was born in 1923.
Well, you see now that it's witchy. I keep using the word witchy to describe things, and that's what that is.
Another thing you wanted to talk about that just made me chuckle. I know it made you laugh. Max rebranded again. It's still called Max, but it's not purple anymore. Now it's monochrome, like HBO.
Now it looks like HBO.
It looks just like HBO. So next step, call it HBO again. But for now, it's... And they literally said, yes, we want to have the family resemblance to HBO. So this is where we are with Max.
It's funny. This could actually be the theme of this podcast, is like, stop evading the real topic, which is, okay, so yes, and Comcast signed a deal, and it's like, great, doesn't solve like the piracy issue. Though CinemaCon people, exhibitors and studios are fighting over, you know, exclusivity windows. Okay, doesn't solve the issue of like the movies being too expensive and nobody wanted to go. And now it's like, well, Max is now gray. So it's basically HBO. We're not going to, it's like, okay, well, your bigger issue is that you can't keep the subscribers you bring in, and you're not growing any kind of meaningful rate, and your business is kind of in the toilet. And so, like, at what point are you going, like, some team somewhere, and this is no disrespect to them because they're doing what they are basically being instructed to do top down. I get it. But some team somewhere thought, got spent thought for months, I'm sure, months, did quality research. And I genuinely mean quality research. I'm not being sarcastic. Did quality research into the type of specific monochromatic color scheme they're going to go with for this and launch this thing. And I can guarantee you they had a little internal party celebrating the launch of this new color to do what? Mm. Like, what is your end game here other than being like, well, they liked HBO, but we don't want to call it HBO because we also have like kids content sometimes, like Ghibli. But we're going to change the color so that people are, by the way, are confused, because I watched Kevin, my fiance, I watched him actively look for the app on the TV because he's like, where's the purple? And that's like, you know, I get that people want to change colors of apps, and I get it. It's like the one thing you can kind of control on the design front and blah, 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 in terms of how people view it. But it's like every time I read a Mac story about them rebranding something or redesigning something, I'm like, but what about your bottom line?
Yeah.
Like, what is actually happening at your business? So it's LOL, but also like a shrug emoticon also meets like a whelp. It's like, here we are.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird story. What do you hope to accomplish? I think that's that. And again, I read a story a few weeks ago where people pointed out, you know, HBO is a big enough brand. It could have encompassed everything. You could have just called it HBO. Everybody had heard of it. You could have just called it that. But instead, we've been in this whole cycle of HBO Max, and then it's Max, and now it's Max with HBO Colors. It's like, okay, I guess this is where we are.
And like, I in my heart of hearts, I feel for Casey Bloys, who's easily one of the greatest minds working in television today in general. He's going to be asked about this over and over again, mm-hmm. and he's going to give a company line answer, even though I will say like he's very, you know, sincere and genuine. That's who he is. But he'll give an answer. And it's like, the man needs to figure out Harry Potter at this point. Like he can't, like, asking him what he thinks about HBO now being Max and the color of Max going from purple to gray and what that says about the future of television. Like, it's such a distraction from anything meaningful. And that's kind of my through line again of this episode. It's just being like, okay, but let's actually address the real problem. Yeah.
They are doing that Harry Potter TV show where they remake the books as seasons. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So the 10 years of Harry Potter, hopefully people still want it.
Maybe. I mean, that's the real question there. But we've talked about that in the past. There are lots of issues going on there. All right. I have a story that I wrote that I wanted to get your reaction to,
which is
a few months ago when they raised Netflix's rates yet again, I got really frustrated. I asked my family, even my kids, do we need to keep Netflix? And everybody was like, meh, it's fine. And so I canceled it. And then what happened is 2 weeks ago on this very podcast, Joe Dalian said, so did you see the John Mulaney talk show? And I said, no, it's on Netflix and I haven't seen it. Like, have you seen Adolescence? I'm like, oh, no. And I thought, okay, this is fine. I'm okay with thinking I'm going to try very hard to cancel Netflix. I'm going to be one of those churn people that I never am. I'm going to be a churner now. And I'm going to come back, and we talked about it. We all know they make the ad plan much cheaper because if you're looking at the average revenue per user, the ARPU, they were making more revenue from the ads than from the premium. And so you jack up the premium price because that's a bad situation to be in. So it's like, oh, great, $8. And they said to me, well, I mean, not personally, I took it personally, but it was just like, look, it's great. The ads are short and seamless. They won't interrupt the action. And I'll grant you, I made a bad decision because we watched Adolescence, episode one, a very tense, dark show about crime and children that is done in one continuous take. And there were four ad breaks, three of them very close to each other, for 30 or 45 seconds of very loud, bright, cheery, energetic ads. And it broke the mood. I haven't really watched outside of sports TV ads in 25 years since I bought a TiVo. I really struggled with it. And the next day, after giving it some thought, I just put us back up on the $18 plan because I couldn't take it.
Yep.
I wrote this story, and Joe Adalian actually emailed me immediately. He was like, yes. And what he made a good point, which was he's surprised that Netflix strategically isn't taking more care with their ad placements for some of their shows, because they've got this prestige show. And it didn't feel like somebody had carefully thought, what are the right ad placements for this show? Maybe we should front load. Maybe we should do a pre-roll. Maybe there should be fewer breaks, but we'll make them a little longer in order, because this is all in one continuous take. And maybe we'll load them a little earlier in the episode because it gets really dark at the end. But no, it felt like it was almost programmatically just shot in there. I think Joe's right. Like, I felt a lack of care with the ad breaks I got, but also just a realization that, like, if Mr. Netflix wants to come to my house and pay me $120 a year to have ads in my Netflix, after that experience, I decided, no. If I'm going to have Netflix, I'm going to pay the extra $120 a year, because I cannot have that experience. And if you are somebody who doesn't mind it and is happy to save $120 on Netflix by getting the ads, that's great. But like, I really went into it thinking it would be okay, and it was so not okay that I couldn't do it, and I gave up.
It's so funny, because I think that's the most anecdotal and perfect encapsulation of the much larger issue facing all of these companies. Because when you have creatives, and echoing what you're saying, like, Adolescence, it's so good, and it's so, like, it's just from the first episode, which it just brings you in. It's like, it's truly captivating in a world where, like, you don't say that as often. And so for Netflix to kind of be like, in an era when you're no longer creating for ads, which we've talked about the show, and I know Joe Adalian is like an amazing expert on this. When you built for ads, you built into your pulse of your show. Yeah. It was very much like, it's like, this is what reality especially does very, very, very well.
Absolutely.
And the idea that when you have people who, a huge group of creatives who have been trained now to write with no ads in mind, and to write almost like a movie, and to kind of pace it as such, to then say, okay, well, we're just going to throw in programmatic ads to break this up, which is what I'm sure they're doing. I agree with you and Joe 100%. Like, I'm sure it's what they're doing. To then go and be like, oh, well, you know, this is the experience. Like, this is the ad supported tier. Everything that you then say as an executive about, well, we really care about the artist's vision, is like, well, no, you don't. Because if that was true with a show like this, which I'm sure Ted Sarandos and Bella Bajaria, who are the, you know, executives at Netflix, who are, they are huge TV and movie fans, like, they genuinely are. And I'm sure for them, it's also annoying, but they wouldn't see it because they're not on ad supported tiers. And so but to not even think ahead of time, having seen that show, which they would have been like, this is a really great show, or even the person in charge of content in the UK in that region, and saying like, hey, on the ad tier, we should just do bumper. So it's like, you have your pre-roll, and then once the credits roll, like, right then you like throw in an ad or whatever it might be, or you charge more for that pre-roll up front. You create a new tier of advertising that you're selling for some of these shows where you're pretty convinced, because they have tracking data on this, it's going to be a big deal. And I think Adolescence was still a remarkable surprise for even people at Netflix. It felt very kind of Squid Game-y in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But like, the idea that you don't do that, and instead it's just, well, it's the ad supported tier and we care about that growing, we don't necessarily care about the experience of that. It's like, well, then what are you telling creators who have also now been trained to write without the ads in mind, and now their experience is being totaled? So I think, it's sometimes the anecdotal stories like those and the personal ones are the ones I hit the most, because it takes you away from the data of like, oh, 50, whatever, 100 people are like on an ad tier.
It's great,
like,
yeah, well, here's what the,
like, exactly.
I get all of that. And I think this is true. While I do believe that my time not watching ads in TV has made it very hard for me to, outside of sports, to deal with ads, I do think that I managed to step in an interesting example that shows the lack of care that's going into what they put, where they put their ads, especially in some of their premium, as Joe pointed out in his email to me, you know, this is a premium bit of content that people are talking about, and it's going to get nominated for awards, and it's a buzz kind of show, and it's really interesting. And at what point, if you're Netflix, do you even have a pathway? And is somebody paying attention and saying, you know what, you know, they obviously can't show this degree of care with everything in their catalog, but for something like this, I stepped in and it felt like there was no care put into the ads at all. And that was the thing that surprised me, is you'd think someone would set up a flare at Netflix and be like, okay, like you said, we need a different kind of program for a show like this, because it's a bad fit with our standard ad load, and we want people to be so satisfied with it that they, you know, the increases the value of Netflix, and we'll get the ads in another place, and we'll get the ad after the credits, and we'll put some up front, and we'll reduce, since it's the single take, we're going to reduce the number of spots, even though we know that having fewer spots with longer breaks decreases the efficacy of the ads. We know that, but for this show, it's the right thing to do. But I got no, and it's early days yet for them, it still is, but like, I got no sense that any care had been put into it at all. And agreed. I guess that's the problem, is if this is a huge part of Netflix's future business, you know, it doesn't have to be for everything, but you probably should be paying attention to how your ads are getting sprayed into your buzz show on the second week that it's on Netflix, because It was a bad experience, and a large part of it was not that there were ads, it was how careless they were with the ads. I also do wonder, yes, I think creators are going to be unhappy with it if they know, because they will also not be looking at the ad tier. And I have to wonder if they're going to start talking to all of their creators and saying, you really need to plan in ad breaks now. Like, you need to go back to a multi-act structure, and here's when the ideal breaks would be for Netflix, and write to it so that we know when the breaks are.
Agreed.
Interesting. I mean, they're usually pretty on it. That's why I was surprised. I thought that it might have been. I know that again, they're new to the ad game, but it was not particularly sophisticated. It was pretty ham-fisted, if I'm honest. I have a bit of listener mail. We love to hear from listeners. Downstreamfeedback.com. Love to hear mothers. This is from Billy, who says, live sports are still the crown jewel of content. The only thing left with massive real-time audiences willing to watch commercials. Broadcast and streaming rights contracts are worth billions. So why isn't every single game shown in 4K HDR at high bit rate, or I would say maybe even high frame rate? Why don't they treat this like the precious beloved commodity it is, and wow their paying audience with the presentation? 4K TVs are pretty standard. Every urban ISP can handle the bitrate. All the streamers do other programming in 4K HDR. I have a little bit of an answer here, which is there are so many sports trucks, and there are so many cameras in so many venues, that this is extremely hard to do, because you're talking about spending hundreds of millions of dollars on infrastructure that was not built for 4K HDR. They're trying. There are certain events, but even like Fox's 4K is just an upscaled 1080. Because again, if you're thinking about baseball, you would have to replace every camera in every stadium and the giant production trucks too. And, you know, a lot of things, it isn't a one-to-one. For baseball, it kind of is. But like for college football, there are only so many trucks. And if you've ever seen an off-brand, you know, a Mountain West game on a Thursday night on ESPN2 or wherever, FS1, you'll see that not all broadcast trucks are created equal. They're still using ones that are pretty low quality and only have a few cameras, because that stuff's expensive. So that's my answer, is I share Billy's frustration. I think there should be more marquee events that are done in 4K HDR and high frame rate. I think we should see more of that for very marquee, important, fancy events. But asking for all of them to be there is not, it just doesn't, the even with all the money involved, it just doesn't make sense, because it's just way too expensive.
Yeah. And I think the only thing I'll add is also most people aren't going to care. Like it's that thing of, okay, the line needs to topple over, right, for us to, then the majority of people are saying we're not going to watch sports unless we can get this, versus the idea of like, we'll pay more for this, you know, kind of like that premium tier for 4K, whatever it might be. The look, to cross that line again to that territory would be a momentous occasion for sports in general, for sports media. And I just don't think we're anywhere close, because for the most part, people, you like, we're talking about watching these great games on our TV sets, and we, a lot of us do. It's a lot of kids who are like, I'll watch it on my phone.
Right.
Yeah. They're like, I don't, like, it doesn't really matter. I'm like barely watching it while I like do other things. So I don't think it's ever going to get there. And to Jason's point, it's a cost reason. But who knows? Maybe as these valuations continue to get inflated, maybe we'll be like, we have all this extra money.
Also, I mean, what's funny is, like, I've noticed, so there's some Fox College Football that's HDR, although again, it's not actually 4K. It's upscaled. The HDR, you notice, the audio, you notice, there's some Premier League stuff that NBC is passing through from the Premier League in the UK that's 4K HDR. Again, I'm not sure I noticed the 4K as much as I noticed the higher bit rate, which is true, and the HDR, which means that the color looks better. There's that broader dynamic range, so it feels a little more real. I think that's what matters. And talking to people in the know, they also say that you know, you might not notice the difference between 720 and 1080 and even 4K for most people. However, improving the bit rate can help, and improving the frame rate can help. And I think that's the next frontier of sports, is somebody saying, you know, we're going to show you a baseball game or a football game, and it's going to be 60 frames per second, and it's going to feel real in a way that it doesn't. And I know this is not like Peter Jackson making Hobbit movies in high frame rate, where film probably wants to induce a dreamlike state and be at 24 frames a second. But for sports, having all that fast action happen smoothly at a higher frame rate, I think that's interesting. And I do think it's telling that all these sports broadcasters made these technical decisions when they made the HD transition 25 years ago and haven't changed. Like, literally, Fox and ESPN are both 720p, not even 1080. Although my understanding is Fox is actually shooting in 1080, and that's where their 4K stream comes from. But on broadcast, they're 720p. And then I think CBS and NBC are 1080i, which again is like, everybody should really be at least 1080p right now, but they're not. And so I don't know. I think there is probably an upgrade that is going to happen, but it's going to be slow, and it's going to initially be focused on premier things. So like Sunday Night Football or maybe Apple. I keep waiting for Apple with their Friday Night Baseball to have like a marquee game where they bring in some 4K cameras and make it look amazing. Maybe if ESPN loses Major League Baseball, whoever picks up Sunday Night Baseball will try something like that. Who knows? But
yeah,
it's going to be slow. It is going to be slow. Sorry, Billy. Downstreamfeedback.com. Send it left to your mothers. We love to hear from you. That was Billy from the 303 doing the area code shout out there. Julia, before we go, when you left, I instituted a new feature because I was going to have TV critics on, called TV Picks, where we say something that we enjoy watching that you might want to enjoy watching. And you're back, but we're still going to do TV Picks. Julia, what's your show that you want to pick this time?
I feel like mine is the same as half the country's, but it's The Pitt. It's the with Noah Wiley, who played John Carter on ER in the 90s. It is a medical show, but that undersells it. It is the most realistic show I've ever seen about the medical profession, especially in an emergency room, to the point that the New York Times wrote a whole article about how much doctors are talking about how much they love it because it's so realistic. And it is the show that Kevin once described to me when he was watching an episode with me, and he said, absolutely nothing and too much happened in that hour, in that 30 minutes, 45 minutes. I said, yeah, that's kind of like an ER. Like, you're waiting around for a bunch of stuff, and then all of a sudden things happen. And they have been doing a lot of work, thinking of adolescents actually, on kind of like incel culture and mass shootings and all that. And it's phenomenal. And so it's almost, I think it's also like the first procedural that a streamer is doing, because it's a Max show and an on HBO show. And to get, you know, that whole fun thing, but really great TV.
I read an interview with Noah Wiley and some of the other producers about how, which I didn't know, that Max actually came to them and said, we want a network procedural on streaming. Yeah. That's what we want. And because of the way the budget is structured, because it's got standing sets, they've got in, you know, they've got, they shoot in LA, which normally you'd be worried about the budget because everybody's shooting elsewhere because of incentives and various things. But because it's a standing set, they can shoot in LA. They're shooting, they shot 15 episodes, way more than your usual streaming series order, because again, they wanted it to have, as you and I have talked about it, how do you build up a catalog of episodes for streaming? Make more episodes is one way to do it. And so they structured their whole budget so they could make 15 episodes a season. And another point that they made that I thought was brilliant is they said, unlike a lot of these really high level, high production value prestige shows, not that The Pitt looks cheap, it doesn't, but because of the way that they've structured the way it's made, they don't have to go away for 2 years and make another 15 episodes. Next January, The Pitt will be back for season two and they'll drop another 15 episodes. They can just keep on pumping them out. It's not 52 weeks a year, but in a streaming universe, pumping out 15 episodes, one a week for 15 weeks, and then you go away and then you come back pretty soon thereafter where you could still remember who the characters are. I love everything about it. Strategically, and the fact that it's also creatively fantastic, one of the best shows going right now. So yeah. I love it. Fully co-endorse it. My pick is going to be The Studio on Apple TV Plus.
So good.
Seth Rogen, Ike Barinholtz. It's very stressful. I've heard from people who are like, this show makes me stressful. I would say because the two guys,
Safdie brothers ask.
Yeah, yeah. The two guys are you know, they're kind of dummies in a way where you're like, I kind of don't mind if bad things happen to them. But it is satire on the entertainment industry, which is very funny. It is very meta. It's also just genuinely funny. It is a funny show. And that I think sometimes gets missed when we talk about, you know, the serious streaming drama and all that. Like, The Studio's a laugh. Like, I laugh out loud at it. It is a funny show. Plus, it's really well made and sort of has something to say. And there's a moment in the first episode, because Seth Rogen is playing a film executive who's taken over a studio. And he says at one point, I've always loved the movies and I'm afraid my job now is to ruin them. And according to Seth Rogen, a studio executive once said that to him. So he was like, and it stuck with him for 20 years and he finally put it in a TV show. It's really good. The Studio, Apple TV Plus. That brings us to the end of this episode. If you have not yet, consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This was a full-size mega episode, but the only way to hear the complete versions of every other episode and hear ad-free episodes is to subscribe. Go to downstream.plus to subscribe and support this show. You can find me at sixcolors.com. I appear on many other podcasts at Relay and theincomparable.com. You can find Julia at puck.news in many places to come, including their Inner Circle, where she's going to be writing very special Inner Circle type content. And who knows where else this new version of Julia Alexander will be. But it was great having you on Downstream again. I'll tell you that much.
Thank you for having me. I have missed yapping with you so much. I have the biggest smile on my face. It is, it's so good to yap and to talk about these things and to rant. It's always a nice little therapy session with you where I get to be like, this doesn't make sense. And then I get to go out into the sunset. Yeah. Like,
well, you know, when you have to write an article, sometimes you have to write an article and they're like, they want your incisive analysis. And that comes sometimes, but sometimes you just have to go, why is this happening? And that's not a great article, but it's something, it's great for a podcast. And then also sometimes you talk about it. And I mean, this is what happens with me when I talk about my, my subject matter is you talk about it on a podcast and it gets the brain going a little bit. And then, you know, a little bit later, a little thought pops out and you're like, oh, now I can write about that. So it's all part of the process.
My most Googled search these last 2 days is, why is this happening? Hey,
there's so many. It's so applicable in so many different ways. Well, let me know if you find out why.
I will.
All right. We will be back with another episode of Downstream in a couple of weeks. But until then, thank you for listening. And Julia, say goodbye.
Bye.